Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident that's ultimately going into radiology. And this is episode 106 of the Divine Intervention podcast. And this podcast will be another review for the ABIM exam, so like basically the medicine board exam and the medicine in training exam, right? And again, this is something that will potentially help a person studying for the USMLE Step 3 exam. So I'm going to continue that theme of cardiology. If you notice, I'm focusing quite a bit on cardio because that's like almost like 20% of the medicine board exam. So I'll kind of focus on that because it's usually, again, the area that maybe tends to give people more trouble than normal, right? So I'll basically try to finish that up before I begin to touch other sections, or at least like talk about it in a very high quantity. So let's just go ahead and jump right into it. What if you get a question about a young athlete that is like exercising and then the athlete like keels over, collapses and dies or something, right? So what's your diagnosis for this patient, right? That'll be hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? And remember, in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right, those people basically have like asymmetric hypertrophy of their interventricular septum, right? And the thing people don't realize is that if you're having hypertrophy, right, of your interventricular septum, the thing is, the intraventricular septum on its own, when it hypertrophies, it takes up space that is normally for the left ventricular outflow tract, right? So that can cause a lot of problems, right? Like, it can basically cause issues where the left ventricle cannot eject appropriately. Another buzz phrase you want to be able to sort of like correlate with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is this thing known as a systolic anterior motion, so SAM. So systolic anterior, I promise you, it's a very high yield buzzword to remember. Systolic anterior motion of the mitral valve, of the anterior mitral valve or leaflet. So basically, the thing that happens is, because of that hypertrophy, again, one of the mitral valve leaflet, is pulled towards the ventricular septum, right? And again, that basically causes like a dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, right? And the thing is, right, so again, classically in a young athlete, and obviously, right, you make the diagnosis with an echocardiogram, right? And the thing is, HCM, your friends that write these exams, they kind of like these cardiac, again, another reason to like cardiology, because it's one of those ways that they can sort of test to see if you actually understand what's going on, right? Because the thing is, the general thinking by the people writing these board exams is that they're like, there's a resident, they worked pretty hard, so they just try to like learn the information real quick and move on, and they don't really like buckle down to understand what they're actually learning, right? So the thing is, these questions, right, obviously, I mean, if you're good at memorizing and all that, fine, you do well on them. Well, the thing is, there are also some of these questions where, like, if you have an understanding of the reasoning behind certain like findings, right, it makes analyzing these questions so much easier, right? Like cardio questions, people look at them, they're like super nebulous, but they're really not. If you understand, if you sort of understand the pathophys behind like certain things, you, as you're reading the question, you basically see exactly through the whatever the test writer is trying to like get you to see, right? In fact, there are many times that I'll read a cardio question, read like the first half of the question, and I pretty much know what they are going after, right? Because it's like they give you all these data. They give you this, they give you this. The data just is like, oh, of course, this is elevated, this is depressed, blah, blah, blah. You know exactly what they're going to talk about, right? Because again, you kind of have an understanding. So I'll sort of try to give you some tips in that regard as we go along, right? So one area that I think is kind of like useful to understand HCM is to understand it in the context of differences with aortic stenosis, because they love to test those things on exams. But the thing is, and again, I will try to explain this as best as I can so I don't give you a headache, and just stick with me and sort of follow me along, and you'll see that this problem subject area can be very easy to understand, right? But before I do that, there is something I want to explain first. Let me explain certain maneuvers and what they do, right? So that when I start saying, oh, if you do this, what happens? If you do this, what happens? It will make sense. So one classic, like, provocative physical exam maneuver that is described a lot on these board exams is the Valsalva maneuver, right? So if you Valsalva, right, you're basically breathing against the closed glottis, right? So that will raise your intrathoracic pressures. If you raise your intrathoracic pressures, you're compressing your SVC. If you compress your SVC, your venous return goes down, right? So if your venous return is going down, your left ventricular volume will decrease because you're just not sending enough blood to the ventricles, right? So that's one thing you want to keep in mind. Now, what if they give you a question and they describe the hand grip maneuver? The thing is, when you grip a person's hand, right, you're compressing arteries. You're compressing like their radial artery, their ulnar artery, right? Remember, those are arteries. So by definition, those are coming from the heart, right? So if you compress those vessels, you're increasing afterload, right? Because it's like, oh, things that drain the heart, you are squishing them down so the heart cannot drain as well. So afterload is increasing when you perform the hand grip maneuver. And think about it. If you increase afterload, it becomes harder for the ventricle to get rid of blood. So the volume in the left ventricle will increase, okay? Now, what if they give you a question and they tell you that the person, a patient stands, right? So think about it. When you stand, you are basically pulling blood in your lower extremities, right? You're pulling blood in your lower extremities. I mean, think of a patient with like chronic venous insufficiency. If that patient is in the hospital and you consult ortho, they're like, raise the patient's leg up, raise the patient's leg up. They're saying raise the leg up, right? So that you can increase, you can basically send that blood back to the heart. So if a patient stands, right, you're pulling blood in your veins. Remember, veins are very good capacitance vessels. So your veins will keep that blood. If your veins keep that blood, right, your preload actually goes down. So when you stand, you're actually decreasing preload. So the volume of the ventricles, especially like the left ventricle, will be decreased in this instance because you're not sending as much blood back. Contrast that with squatting. If you squat on an exam, right, you're squishing those lower extremity veins. When you squish those lower extremity veins, you're actually increasing venous return because by squishing those veins, you are decreasing their capacitance and you're basically compressing the blood out of them and sending them right back to the SVC and IVC. Okay, so just something to sort of keep at the back of your mind. So now you understand that, let's ask ourselves, right, what are the classic ways or maneuvers? Because believe it or not, you may say, oh, Divine, this is too detailed. I promise you it's not. At least I certainly got the chance to take the medicine in training exam. I will tell you that these maneuvers and like, the murmur gets louder with this, gets softer with that. I promise you these things are tested pretty frequently. Okay, so if a person has, and the reason they like to test HCM in the context of aortic stenosis is because it has many similar findings, but there are some salient differences, right? So, for example, if a patient has a hypertrophic or cardiomyopathy, they will have like a mid-systolic murmur, right? They will have like the mid-systolic ejection murmur. You'll hear it really well at the right upper sternal border, right? But the thing is, in aortic stenosis, right, you know that murmur radiates to the carotids. In hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the murmur actually does not radiate to the carotids. That's one key difference you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then another thing is, if you think about it, anything that puts more blood in the left ventricle will make the murmur of aortic stenosis worse. And why is that? Think about it. If you put more blood in the left ventricle, right, that means the left ventricle has more blood that it can push forward through the aortic valve, the stenosed aortic valve. And if you have that, right, the murmur will get louder because you're using that valve more. Now, the thing is, in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right, the thing is, remember I talked about that buzzword where you have like the asymmetric septal hypertrophy, and you have that SAM, that systolic anterior motion of a mitral valve leaflet. The thing is, basically, the ventricular septum coming together with that mitral valve leaflet is what constitutes the dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction that causes many of the symptoms in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So here's the thing. Whenever there is more blood in the left ventricle, that actually separates that mitral valve leaflet from the hypertrophied interventricular septum. So that will obviously make the murmur better. It will make it not sound as loud. Okay? So the key principle you want to remember, because you, like, instead of memorizing this crap maneuver, just remember the concept. Anything that increases the amount of blood in the left ventricle will keep the hypertrophied interventricular septum and the leaflet of the mitral valve apart, So that will increase flow through the left ventricular outflow tract. You're basically relieving the obstruction. So the murmur sounds softer. Okay. So anything that increases the volume in the left ventricle will make the murmur of HCM sound better. Okay. It will sound softer. It won't be as loud. Contrast that with aortic stenosis, where anything that increases the volume of blood in the left ventricle will make the murmur sound louder. Again, because you're having more flow through that stenosed aortic valve. The thing is, when you increase the volume of blood in the left ventricle, you're essentially relieving the dynamic stenosis that constitutes hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Again, it's super important to understand this point, right? So if, for example, a person has like hand grip, right? If you have hand grip, that will keep more blood in the left ventricle. And if you keep more blood in the left ventricle, the murmur of HCM will sound softer. Okay, so again, very important to understand that, right? And remember, I told you that in HCM, the murmur does not radiate to the carotids, right? So that's important to know. And remember, in aortic stenosis, right, you probably remember this buzzword from back in the day, like in med school, where they talk about like the pulsus parvus a tardus, right? So tardus, the word a tardus means tardy, right? Like a kid that's coming late to school, right? So in aortic stenosis, you have like the delayed carotid upstroke, right? The thing is, the carotid upstroke in HCM is actually not delayed. So again, that's another difference that can sort of help you delineate between aortic stenosis and hypertrophic or cardiomyopathy on any of these exams. Now, the thing is, how do you treat hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? So classically on these exams, you basically give them something that makes the heart go slower, right? Because think about it. If your heart is going slower, right, that means it will have more time to fill. If your heart has more time to fill, you're increasing the volume of blood in the left ventricle. If you increase the volume of blood in the left ventricle, you are relieving that dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction. And that essentially fixes some of the problems you have in a HCM, right? So you can give like a beta blocker, you can give a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So like verapamil or diltiazem, because those slow the heart down. So the heart spends more time in diastole, right? So the ventricles are filling, because that's what happens in diastole. And then, I mean, that asymmetric septal hypertrophy, you can do like a surgical myomectomy. So you call cardiothoracic surgery, they chop up some of the person's interventricular septum, although people tend to get like heart block after that happens, or like a bundle branch block or something. And then if they give you a whiff in the question that the patient has like a bad arrhythmia, like VTAC happening every now and then, right? For those people, you want to go ahead and place an ICD, right? Because that will sort of decrease their risk of having like sudden a cardiac death. And then you can also give those people like Amio. You can put them on amiodarone, right? To sort of like make them not have these bad rhythms. Although, if I'm not mistaken, amiodarone has actually not been shown to decrease the risk of sudden cardiac death in patients with HCM. It's placing an ICD that has been shown to decrease the incidence of a sudden cardiac death in as far as I remember, if I'm remembering correctly, in HCM. So, and then one other thing your friends that write these exams love to do with HCM is they love to talk about like things that you should probably avoid in patients that have HCM, right? Remember, I told you that anything that puts more blood in the left ventricle keeps that ventricular septum and the mitral valve leaflet apart. So that relieves the left ventricular outflow tract obstruction. Guess what? If you put less blood in the left ventricle, that will basically worsen their condition, right? I mean, I've just explained that like many, many different times. So you want to like not give those people diuretics on an exam, right? Because again, diuretics will dry you out. That will decrease preload and that will make the condition worse, right? You don't want to give them a nitrate. Remember, your nitrates are venodilators. So by dilating veins, you decrease preload and that'll make the condition worse, right? I mean, you've heard the story, oh, athlete is working out hard or playing a game, keels over and dies, right? I mean, why do you think that really happens in HCM? Think about it, right? If you're working out, what are you doing? What's your skin doing? You're sweating a ton. If you're sweating a ton, right, you're basically losing volume. By losing volume, you're decreasing preload. You're decreasing preload, you're worsening the left ventricular outflow tract obstruction because there's less blood in the left ventricle. So that may like exacerbate symptoms and then they die. That's why they tell people with HCM, basically stop working out, right? So that you don't get into trouble. So I think that's all I'll say about HCM. I mean, for the folks that are taking step three, the thing you may see tested that's above and beyond what I've mentioned now is HCM, right? It's autosomal dominant inheritance, right? So you should definitely try to know that. And then don't forget that it arises from mutations in like the myosin heavy chain, like the beta myosin heavy chain. That's like the classic thing they tend to describe on exams. And they may tell you that, oh, the dad died in a car accident or some like weird crap, right? At the age of like 30. The dad did not die in the car accident because he was like reckless on the road. He probably had an arrhythmia and died on the spot, okay? So that's the classic history they give on these exams. Okay, now, since I sort of talked about like try to compare and contrast the HCM and aortic stenosis, right? Because those are two like somewhat similar murmurs. Let me go ahead and talk about like just differentiating between mitral valve prolapse and mitral regurge, right? Mitral valve prolapse and mitral regurge, because those are two other murmurs that they love to compare and contrast with, like, oh, what makes it sound better, what makes it sound louder, what makes it sound softer, so that you don't get into trouble on your test. So the thing is, again, you don't have to memorize crap, just remember the principle. The thing is, in mitral regurge, if you put more volume in the left ventricle, right, there will be more blood in the left ventricle to regurgitate through the bad valve, okay? So anything that increases the amount of blood in the left ventricle will make the murmur of mitral regurge sound louder, okay? Now, mitral valve prolapse, in fact, I wish I could make like a schematic, but basically, just think of it this way. Picture in your mind that you have like the mitral valve leaflets, like the two mitral valve, I mean, right, the mitral valve is called a bicuspid valve for a reason. It has two leaflets, right? So the thing is, in mitral valve prolapse, those leaflets don't overlap well, right? And because they are not overlapping well, then you have basically like regurgitation, okay? So the thing is, whenever you actually, so here's the critical concept. Whenever you put more blood in the left ventricle, those two mitral valve leaflets overlap appropriately. They overlap the way they were created to overlap. And if they overlap appropriately, the regurgitation goes away. So the concept is, whenever you have more blood in the left ventricle, mitral valve prolapse actually sounds softer. Contrast that with mitral regurge, whenever you have more blood in the left ventricle, mitral regurge sounds louder, because again, there is more blood for regurgitation across the valve if there is more blood in the left ventricle, versus in mitral valve prolapse, where if there is more blood in the left ventricle, you will have like a more natural overlap of the two mitral valve leaflets, so you have less regurgitation, so the murmur sounds softer. Okay, so again, if you understand those concepts and then put it together with my explanation of like hand grip, standing, squatting, all that crap, you'll see that you can analyze like, oh, this will make this sound softer, this will make this sound worse, and blah, 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 right? So think of it this way. So say, for example, right, you do the Valsalva maneuver, right? If you do the Valsalva maneuver, that will decrease preload. If you decrease preload, there will be less blood in the left ventricle. And if there is less blood in the left ventricle, mitral regurge will sound softer, right? Because there's less blood in the left ventricle, so there's less blood to regurge through the bad valve. But if the patient has mitral valve prolapse, they will have less blood in the left ventricle, so there will be very unfavorable overlap of the two mitral valve leaflets, so the murmur will sound louder. Okay, so that's the way to sort of keep those two straight. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about those murmurs for now. So I think I'm going to go ahead and move on, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient that presents, and they present with like the classic orthopnea, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, and they have like 3 plus edema, right? You already know that. And then they usually put like an S3 heart sound on an exam, right? If you see that, I hope you're thinking about like a CHF exacerbation, right? So how do you treat a CHF exacerbation, right? Obviously, if you're hypoxic, from it, you want to sort of like put them on oxygen, right? But the big thing you want to do is loop diuretics, right? So like loop diuretics, like furosemide, right? That will sort of like get rid of some of those fluid. Remember, your loop diuretics work in the kidneys. Basically by giving a loop, right, think about it, you're drying them out, so you're decreasing preload, so you're basically giving their hearts a break for the most part, and you're decreasing that edema, right, like that pulmonary edema that's sort of like making their lungs wet and making it hard for them to breathe, right, to exchange oxygen efficiently, right. I mean, another thing you can actually also do is to give like morphine. It can actually help with some of the shortness of breath. In fact, they'll usually make it in a patient that has like really bad CHF that's like terminal. So let's say like the EF is like 10%, multiple readmissions. The correct answer on the exam for those people can actually be morphine, especially if they tell you in the question that they've been given like loop diuretics and all that crap. And then, right, don't forget, like, as clinical pearls, don't forget to measure your eyes and nose, see if they're net negative, check their electrolytes. Remember, if a patient is in CHF exacerbation, you usually give pretty heavy doses of Lasix. Remember, Lasix can cause, like, hypokalemia and hyponatremia and all that garbage. So you want to sort of keep an eye on those patients' electrolytes, right? And then you want to do, like, daily weights and all that. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say. So let's see, what else do I want to talk about? Yeah, I've just gone for 21 minutes. So, I think there's more stuff I can talk about. Okay, how about I give you this case? So what if they give you a question about a patient and the patient says, like in the Q-stem, they tell you that this patient has pleuritic chest pain, right? They tell you that, oh, when he takes a deep breath, chest really hurts, right? But when he leans forward, the chest pain sort of goes away. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? I really hope you're thinking about pericarditis, right? So remember, acute pericarditis usually presents with like your classic pleuritic chest pain, gets worsened when you lie back, gets better when you lean forward, right? And usually those patients will have a fever on an exam, right? And then they may tell you that on auscultation, you have like a friction rub, right? And sometimes people say like divine, but people that have like, I don't know, like viral pleuritis, right? They will also have a friction rub. So here's the way you differentiate those two things on exams, right? If they tell you that when the patient holds their breath, the friction rub disappears, then that tells you that it has to be pericarditis, right? Because if you hold your breath, guess what is not moving against each other anymore? Your pleura. Your pleura is not moving against each other. So the pleuritis, like friction rub, goes away. But it's not like when you hold your breath, your heart stops beating, right? That doesn't really happen. Your heart will keep beating. I mean, if you hold your breath for long enough, your heart probably stops, but doesn't stop instantly, right? So your heart will keep beating. So you still keep having contact between your pericardial layers, right? So you'll keep having the friction. You will keep auscultating the friction rub, right? And then remember, right, on EKG, right, classically, these patients with pericarditis, they'll have like the diffuse ST segment elevation. They'll have the PR segment depression. Remember, the ST segment elevation is usually like pretty diffuse, right? So it's like, you're like, man, this ST segment elevation does not appear to be obeying any particular vascular territory. When you see that, think about a pericarditis, right? And again, they may have like diffuse PR segment depression. But let me tell you this, classically on these exams, they may not give you the diffuse PR segment depression you're looking for. They may just give you like the PR segment depression in lead 2. Having a PR segment depression in lead 2 on these exams, like these are ABIM exams or like the MBME exams, they are very classic for pericarditis. So that's something to keep at the back of your mind. And one thing I'll encourage you to do, this is again just a clinical pearl. If a patient comes with pericarditis, it probably makes sense to go ahead and check the troponin. Don't just say, oh, diffuse ST elevation, so they cannot be having an MI or something. You don't want to get burned, right? I'm sure like there'll be a nice attorney that'll be willing to come and extract some of your income. So I will encourage you under those circumstances, just still check your troponin just to make sure you're covering all your all your bases, right? And I mean, I know that for the most part, you know these guidelines that, oh, if you're more than 2 hours away from a PCI-capable center, you should go ahead and give TPA if a patient has an MI. The thing is, that's why you kind of want to make the right diagnosis of acute pericarditis, because here's the thing. If a patient has pericarditis and you're like, ST segment elevations, it's an MI, and you give TPA, you basically increase the patient's risk of converting from pericarditis to acute cardiac tamponade, and then you have a huge problem on your hands. You can go from a situation where the patient can live for a while to like dying instantly. So I kind of want to be careful with that, right? So try to make the correct diagnosis. So how do you treat acute pericarditis, right? Like you can give aspirin. Usually I'll say on these exams, aspirin plus an NSAID is usually a pretty good choice. Another classic scenario they can present the person that is having like recurrent, like they keep coming to the hospital for pericarditis. For those patients, you also still want to give the aspirin, but the thing you can add is like a long course of a colchicine. Okay. Before, people used to say, oh, steroids for pericarditis. But it does look like there's some studies that are coming out that actually show that steroids appear to increase a person's risk of recurrence of pericarditis. So I will say that on these exams, think more about like aspirin plus an NSAID for like the acute event. And then if you're having like recurring pericarditis, like aspirin plus a steroid. Okay. Aspirin plus colchicine, like a long course, like maybe like 3 months of colchicine. So that's just something to keep in mind. And you usually give like the big aspirin doses, right? So like your MI dose, basically. Okay. What are the classic patients that get pericarditis on these exams, right? So commonly it can be like a post-viral, right? So they have like a viral upper respiratory infection and then they get pericarditis afterwards, right? So that's something that can cause that. Don't forget, if they give you like an immigrant or a person like from some developing country, think about TB, right? TB can cause pericarditis in these people. People that have like these autoimmune diseases, or I guess you can call them connective tissue diseases. So like, I don't know, like lupus or like rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma, they can all have pericarditis, right? And then if a patient has like radiation therapy to the chest, right? So like for a lymphoma, right? That can increase their risk of like pericarditis. Radiation is known to cause like pleuritis, pericarditis. Remember, right? Having radiation to the chest is the biggest risk factor for thyroid cancer, right? Like especially like papillary thyroid cancer on these exams. So that's just something like a side piece of knowledge you want to keep in mind. Remember, right, uremia, right? So they can give you like a renal patient with pericarditis. Think about uremia as the cause. Remember, uremia can also cause like bleeding because you may have a normal platelet count, but your platelets don't work well. Because remember, right, uremia sort of makes platelets unable to degranulate appropriately. So that can sort of like increase your risk for like a bleeding, like a coagulopathy. Also, uremia, right, sort of makes your white blood cells not degranulate appropriately. So that's why renal patients are kind of like at high risk for infection, okay? Because their white blood cells basically don't work right. And then don't forget, right, another classic scenario is like a post-MI patient, right? So especially an MI patient that gets like CABG, right? So like a post-pericardiotomy syndrome, right? After like open heart surgery, people can get pericarditis with that. And then also MI, remember like your Dressler syndrome, right? Like the autoimmune pericarditis, you again treat that with like an NSAID, aspirin, the works, right? So it's an autoimmune pericarditis, tends to show up like a week or two after the MI event, right? It can even show up to 6 weeks later. So think about Dressler syndrome as another cause of pericarditis, right? And then remember that if a person has like long-standing pericarditis or like repeated episodes of pericarditis, right, they can go from acute pericarditis to like something called constrictive pericarditis, right? Constrictive pericarditis. And the thing is, constrictive pericarditis is really bad. But the thing is, constrictive pericarditis, it's usually pretty easy to make the diagnosis. So think about it, right? That's why I kind of like a test prep, because it's kind of like logical. The thing is, if you really think about it, how can they make a constrictive pericarditis question hard? The easy way they can make it hard is to write the question to look a lot like restrictive cardiomyopathy, right? So really the big thing you want to know about constrictive pericarditis is, how can I differentiate this crap from restrictive cardiomyopathy, right? Because the management is kind of different, right? So you want to make the right diagnosis. And another reason you want to make the right diagnosis is so you don't fail your exam, right? So that's probably a nice added motivation there, right? So remember, if a person has constrictive pericarditis, you can reverse it with a pericardiectomy, right? So get rid of the pericardial sac and the patient will be fine. Versus restrictive cardiomyopathy, where you're going after like a heart transplant, right? And so let me just try and differentiate some of these things for you. And then I'll tell you like some things that are kind of specific to constrictive pericarditis, right? So the thing is, I already talked about the causes of pericarditis, right? Restrictive cardiomyopathy, you want to think more about like infiltrative disease as the etiology, right? So the thing is, here's a trick I've used quite successfully on many exams. Anything that ends in osis, so osis, like O-S-I-S, anything that ends in osis causes restrictive disease of the heart and lungs. Okay, that's like a nice trick there. Like, think of, restrictive lung disease, right? Sarcoidosis causes restrictive lung disease. Pulmonary fibrosis causes restrictive lung disease. If you look at restrictive cardiomyopathy, right, look at the causes. Amyloidosis. Amyloidosis is actually the most common cause, very high yield to know that, is the most common cause of restrictive cardiomyopathy, right? But other things that can cause restrictive cardiomyopathy, sarcoidosis, hemochromatosis, right? Hereditary fibroelastosis, right? Those things all end in osis, right? They all cause restrictive cardiomyopathy. And then in constrictive pericarditis, right? So there are some key things you want to keep in mind, right? So those people can have something called like Kussmaul sign, right? So Kussmaul sign, right? It's basically like when a person has like an increase in JVP, when they take a deep breath, when they inspire, okay? When they inspire. Right. This is something that you see a lot in our constrictive pericarditis on exams. Right. And you may think, you may say, Divine, why is that? Well, think about it. If you inspire, right, what happens to your intrathoracic pressures? Your intrathoracic pressures go down. So if your intrathoracic pressures go down, it's like your right ventricle, right atrium will be more accepting of blood. Right. So your preload, your venous return should increase. Right. And the thing is, that increase is brought about because when you inspire, you're decreasing your venous, you're decreasing your intrathoracic pressures, your right atrium, right ventricle is relaxing. Your jugular veins should basically collapse with inspiration, right? Because it's like, oh, you are decreasing the pressures in that system because the intrathoracic pressures are down. But think about it. If a person has constrictive pericarditis, your right ventricle is no longer compliant because guess what's happening? It's been like, Basically, it's like there's stone, like it's like you've basically like cemented your ventricular walls, right? So your right ventricle is not compliant. So even if you inspire, that decrease in like pressures in the right side of your heart does not happen. So that in your body is like, oh, I just inspired. So let me bring more blood to the right side of the heart, but it's like the blood gets there, and because your right ventricle is not compliant, it has nowhere to go. So your JVD, your JV like pressure actually increases. So if you have an increase in JVD on inspiration, that's Kussmaul sign. That's the pathophysiology. Think about constrictive pericarditis on your exam. And then in constrictive pericarditis, if you're also looking at the JVP like tracings, you'll get like the X and the Y descent, like a rapid X, Y descent. I will talk about the pathophysiology behind that at the tail end of this podcast. And then another classic thing they will show you is they can show you like a chest X-ray or show you like a CAT scan of the chest. And you see like white around the heart. Those are calcifications, right? So if you see those calcifications around the heart, you can probably pretty much stop reading the question. It's constrictive pericarditis. Just pick an answer related to it and move on. And then they may tell you that, oh, when you auscultate the chest, they will have like a diastolic like knock, like a pericardial knock sound. Okay. That's pretty classic again for constrictive pericarditis. You hear the knock because again, it's like you've cemented the borders of your heart, right? So think about it. Try to knock your thighs. I'm knocking my thighs right now. You can barely hear anything. But if you're knocking a table, you can hear that. If you're like knocking like something that's hard, like calcified pericardium, you'll hear that pericardial knock sound. And then, I mean, another sneaky way they can try to test you on this is, instead of showing you an image where they show you like calcium or like white around the ventricles, they may just show you that, they may show you like the pericardium being thick. If you see like a thick pericardium, also think about constrictive pericarditis. The thing is, usually on imaging, you should not be able to measure, at least by like your eye, you should not be able to measure the width of the pericardium. If you're able to measure the width, that tells you that the pericardium is thickened. Think about constrictive pericarditis under those circumstances. And then another thing you kind of want to think about, it's like this finding, like this is how they can basically make a constrictive pericarditis question like really hard, right? They can basically give you pressures in all the four chambers of the heart, right? And maybe like, what are they going after here? This is something you really want to think about. If you have equal pressures, or they tell you that, oh, there's equalization of pressures in all the chambers of the heart in diastole, okay? In diastole, the first thing you want to think about is constrictive pericarditis. Another thing you should also think about on exams is a cardiac tamponade, right? They can have those issues. Again, because again, think about it. In diastole, right, the heart is supposed to be able to relax, right? And remember that in diastole, you're basically filling the ventricles from the atria. So you may say, Divine, come on, who cares? If the pressures in the four chambers of the heart are all equal in diastole, what's my problem there? Let me explain why that should be a consideration for you. Think about it. Remember, for you to be able to have flow, you need to have pressure differentials, right? Like things flow from high pressure to low pressure. So guess what? If the pressure in your right atrium is the same as the pressure in your right ventricle and there is no pressure differential, guess what happens to filling of the right ventricle? It doesn't happen. And if your right ventricle does not fill, I don't know, maybe you won't be sending blood to your lungs. If you don't send blood to your lungs, you get hypoxic, right? And then you run into a lot of trouble. So that's why cardiac tamponade and the constrictive pericarditis are not necessarily good things, right? So those are the two conditions on these exams that are classically associated with equalization of pressures in all four chambers of the heart during diastole. So you may say, okay, Divine, if these two conditions have this same finding, how do I differentiate between them, right? So the thing is, if a person has constrictive pericarditis, they will have like that rapid X descent on jugular venous pressure tracing. But if a person has cardiac tamponade, they will have like an absent X descent. So that's the way to sort of differentiate those two. And the thing is, the reason people that have constrictive pericarditis, they tend to have like more right-sided problems is, if you really think about it, right, the right side of the heart at baseline has lower filling pressures than the left side. So if there is something that is compressing the cardiac chambers, the right side is going to feel it more because it just has less ability to resist anything compressing it from the outside. Okay. So I think that's all I'm going to say about a constrictive pericarditis. But I feel like since I've said a lot about like this jugular venous pressure tracings, let me just go ahead and in 4 or 5 minutes, just real quick, go through like the key things, like key pathology, like basically go through like the JVP tracings and then go over like key pathologies that are associated with them, right? So you may say, do you necessarily need to understand this for these exams? No, to be honest with you. But the thing is, if you understand them, cardiology questions become like layups. I mean, if you're a basketball fan, you know what a layup is. Basically, if you see a cardiology question, if you really get, like, the thing is, cardiology is one of those fields where if you really understand the physiology, the questions are like a joke, because you're like, regardless of how hard they write it, you can sort of read through whatever crap that the person that wrote the question is trying to throw at you, right? So you can skip this part if you're like, just memorize stuff and move on. That's fine. But if you want to kind of understand, just give me like 4 or 5 minutes of your time, and I promise I'll make it worth your while, right? So let's talk about, I guess, like the chemistry of a JVP, right? So in a JVP, the first thing you want to think about is the A wave, right? And your A wave, it basically arises from, it's like a pressure increase in that you see in your jugular veins, right? From your right atrium contracting, right? So if your right atrium is contracting, think about it, right? Your atrial pressures will go up. If your atrial pressures go up, you'll sort of see like a like an increase in pressure or like a pulsation in your jugular vein, right? So that's the big thing you want to keep in mind. So what are the pathologies of the A wave that you may want to keep in mind for these tests, right? They may tell you that this patient has no A wave, or they can show you a jugular venous pulse where there is no A wave, like a flattening of the A wave. If you see that, you want to think about AFib, right? Because remember, in AFib, you don't have like a coordinated like atrial squeeze. So if you don't have a coordinated atrial squeeze, you're basically not contracting well as a right right atrium, right? So your A wave will disappear because the A wave is significant, like signifies contraction of the right atrium. Now, what did they tell you that the patient has giant A waves? Giant A waves. So the thing is, think about it. If the right atrium needs to generate more force than is required for to move blood from the right atrium to the right ventricle, right? The right atrial A wave should be bigger than normal, right? So think about if a patient has like tricuspid stenosis, for example, that can cause, that can make the right atrium have to work harder to send blood forward. So you need to generate more force with like contraction, right? And that can cause like the giant A wave. Now, another thing you may see if they really want to mess up your mind on tests is the Cannon A wave, right? So the Cannon A wave is basically an A wave that, because normally the A wave sort of like has a gentle upslope and then a gentle downslope. But if you see like an A wave that basically looks like a straight triangle, like goes up and down abruptly, that's what's known as a Cannon A wave. That basically happens when you're like your right atrium is contracting, when like the tricuspid valve is closed, shut, right? So what's the classic scenario with that on exams? That would be like a third degree AV block, right? Remember, then the atria and the ventricles, they're basically not talking to each other anymore. So the right atrium can be contracting when the right ventricle is contracting, which is not what is supposed to happen, right? So that's the situation where the right atrium can contract against like a closed tricuspid. That's what will classically cause the Cannon A wave on these exams. Now, the next thing that sort of comes up is like the C wave, right? So the C wave, basically, the thing is, after the right atrium contracts, you know, sends blood to the right ventricle, the tricuspid valve then closes, right? And once the tricuspid valve closes, right, the right ventricle is contracting. But remember, the right ventricle does not begin to eject into the pulmonic system immediately when the tricuspid valve closes, right? I mean, if you remember from med school, whatever, you probably remember this whole concept of isovolumic or isovolumetric contraction. The thing is, like, I sort of think of it as like the right ventricle kind of like warming up before it sends blood to the pulmonary arteries, right? So the C wave is the next wave. It basically happens when the tricuspid valve and the pulmonic valve is closed, right? So the right ventricle is contracting. As the right ventricle is contracting, it will try to like blow back some blood to the right atrium, but the tricuspid valve is like closed shut. So it's like the tricuspid valve will like blow back into the right atrial like cavity or like lumen, if you may. So that will transiently raise the pressures in the right atrium. And that's pretty much all you need to know about the C wave. Now, the X descent. So the X descent, it's actually like a blood pressure decrease. I mean, like a right atrial pressure decrease. So remember I just said that, oh, for the C wave, the tricuspid valve is closed, the pulmonic valve is closed, the right ventricle contracts, you have a blowback of blood, and as you're having that blowback of blood, that blood sort of like slaps against the tricuspid valve. When it slaps against the tricuspid valve, the tricuspid valve sort of bulges back into the right atrium. When it bulges back into the right atrium, that transiently raises the right atrial pressures. Now, the thing is, what then happens when the pulmonic valve opens, right? When the pulmonic valve opens, all that pressure that has been building up from the right ventricle, kind of like warming up, it sort of dissipates because there is now like an open road for the blood to flow through the pulmonic valve to like the lungs, right? So the thing is, that tricuspid valve that bulged back when we had the C wave, it will now bulge in to the right ventricle. And if it bulges into the right ventricle, then that's like lowering the pressures in the right atrium, right? Lowering the pressures in the right atrium. And when you lower those pressures in the right atrium, right, the right atrium kind of relaxes and is more willing to accept blood. And as it's accepting that blood, obviously, right, blood will leave your, like, your internal jugular vein, right? So you have like a decrease in pressure on your jugular venous pulse, right? So the thing is, if you do not see any X descent, right, that tells you that your atria is really not relaxing as it should, right? So that can happen if, for example, something bad happens where your tricuspid valve is incompetent, right? So like a tricuspid regurge, if you have a tricuspid regurge, instead of the atria to be relaxing, it's accepting some blood back from the right ventricle. So that can cause like an absent X descent. But another thing you can think about is if a person has like a prominent X descent, the thing is, when one thing that can cause like a pressure tracing to be more prominent is if things happen abruptly, right? So I sort of think of it this way, right? So let's assume you're driving on the highway, right? And you see like the police like a mile ahead of you because you have like X-ray vision or something like that. You can slow down gradually over a large distance, right? So the people in your car will be like, oh, you're such a good driver, you're slowing down gradually, right? Well, let's assume you see a police officer, like a police car, and you see them like measuring the speed, like, I don't know, like 300 feet away from you, and you try to like decrease your speed, you hit the brakes abruptly and your vehicle just sort of like comes to like an abrupt stop, right? So the thing is, that happens when you're like stopped in your tracks over a very short distance. So the thing is, if a person has constrictive pericarditis, when blood hits the right ventricle, it hits it like very abruptly, right? Because it's like the right ventricle is not very compliant. So because you are having that just abrupt, like it's like you're stopping the blood in the right ventricle like abruptly in its tracks, that can basically cause like that relaxation of the like the right ventricle like contracting and sending blood out through the pulmonic valve. That sort of makes that process like end quicker than you expect. So your X descent, because it's like, oh, normally things are gradual, no, it just happens quickly. So you have a prominent X descent. Kind of like the same thing actually happens with the Y descent as well, but I'll talk about that in like a minute, because there's one thing that happens before you have the Y descent. The thing that happens before that is like your V wave, right? So your V wave is basically like an increase in your right atrial pressure. That just happens because now you're having like venous return, right? So more blood is coming to the right atrium from like your vena cava and all that crap, right? So obviously, if blood is being dumped in the right atrium, that will increase the pressures in the right atrium. The classic thing they can test is if a person has like a giant V wave, right? So giant V wave, that will happen if more blood, like more blood than normal, is coming back to the right atrium, right? So again, if you have like tricuspid regurge, right? It's like the right atrium is accepting blood from the SVC, IVC, but it's also accepting blood from the right ventricle, right? So that will cause like a giant V wave. And then the Y descent basically happens when you're having like ventricular diastole, right? So blood is filling the right ventricle from the right atrium. Obviously, as blood is filling the right ventricle from the right atrium, the pressures in the right atrium will decrease, right? So it would like sort of empty, and that will decrease the pressures, right? So you have like a decrease in pressure. That's your Y descent. It's called the descent, right? Because things are going down, right? So the thing is, think about it, right? If a person has like a cardiac tamponade, right? In cardiac tamponade, right? Because think about it, if your right atrium is emptying with blood, it should relax. But if your right atrium is empty, but there's still all this pressure from the outside because there's fluid around the heart, right? Your right atrium will not be able to relax, right? So that relaxation that should happen, that wide descent that should happen, sort of disappears. So you have no wide descent in a cardiac tamponade. But again, if you remember when I said that if you have like tricuspid stenosis, right, it's like if you have stenosis, it's like, yeah, you can let blood out of the right atrium, but you are letting it out at like a slower pace than normal because there's just like less room for the blood to go through the stenosis, the tricuspid valve. That can cause like a more gentle wide descent, if you may. And then remember constrictive pericarditis, like that abrupt crap that happens, right? If you have like a large, like a prominent abrupt wide descent, think about constrictive pericarditis under those circumstances. So I know this was a lengthy podcast, but really, I promise you, if you understand this, it will just make analyzing many of these cardiology questions a lot easier. And then, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here, so I'll put you out of your misery. But as I always say, hopefully you've gotten something from this, and I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, so step 1, step 2 CK, 2 CS, step 3, the COMLEX exams, the preclinical med school exams, the third year shelf exams. I do actually tutor some people for the medicine boards and medicine in training exam. And then if you have like a colleague or acquaintance that is in college and studying like biochem, ochem, genchem, physics, histology, physiology, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all those things as well. If you're preparing an application, right, so let's say you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS app, I do offer like one-on-one consulting for those, so like preparing applications, personal statements, mock interviews, stuff like that. I also do that one-on-one. I mean, all the people I advise this past cycle, they all matched because I've actually been on like the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a whole year. So I've sifted through thousands of high quality applications. So I know the things that can basically like help you put your best foot forward. So I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day, and I guess have a wonderful night because I'm actually going to bed right now. It's almost a midnight. I gotta go to the ICU tomorrow. So I'll see you in the next podcast. Sleep well, and God bless you. Thank you.